Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app.
Get tender USDA choice boneless chuck roast or stew meat for $6.99 a pound. Then get 2 liter bottles of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $1.49 each, all with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Season 20, Episode 4.
This is Writing Excuses.
Puppetry as a writing metaphor.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Howard.
And today we are going to be talking about my favorite subject, puppetry. So the idea that we've got for you with this, and we're going to be doing this all season, is that the lived experience that we all have affects the way we think about writing. You've heard me talk about puppetry for basically 17 seasons now, since I first appeared on season 3, episode 14. But I wanted to do kind of a deeper dive into actually thinking about it as a metaphor, as a way for you to also begin thinking about things in your own life you can use as writing metaphors. So this is going to be a lot of me talking, but everybody else is going to chime in at some point.
Eventually.
So in season three, episode 14, I talk about the four principles of puppetry: focus, breath, muscle, and meaningful movement. And I talk about those as a way to think about character. What I also want to talk about is a way to think about puppetry as thinking about how it informs the way I think about genre, how it informs the way I think about the lens, the voice with which we write. And so I actually want to start by talking about voice, mm-hmm. since we're talking about lenses. I think that there's this wonderful thing in puppetry that writers can use. So you've heard people say, oh, it's very important to develop your voice, and don't worry about developing your voice. Your voice will come naturally. I love the voice of this. So we use the word voice to mean three different things. And when you're talking about puppetry, you talk about the style of puppetry, and that means three different things. There's the mechanical style, there's the aesthetic style, and then there's the personal style. So the mechanical style is literally, are you using a marionette? Are you using a hand puppet? Is it a giant body puppet? And with writing, that mechanical style would be things like first person, third person, YA, which has a different mechanical style, or middle grade in particular has a different mechanical mm-hmm. style than adult. Gaming has a different mechanical style than prose. So what style of writing are you doing? And then aesthetic is, what does it look like? Does it look like a Muppet? Does it look like something that's hand-carved from Appalachia? Does it, you know, what does it look like? And for writing, that is, you know, does it sound like it's Jane Austen? Does it sound like it is from the Bronx? Does mm-hmm. it sound like...
Elmore Leonard.
And then the personal is that if you hand the same puppet to two different puppeteers, it looks like a different character, which is why after Jim Henson died and Steve Whitmire took over Kermit the Frog, everybody kind of freaked out because there are just subtle differences, even though it's obviously hitting the same mechanical and aesthetic, because there are these subtle differences that affect the choices that the performer makes. And that is the same thing that means that you as a writer are the only person who can write the book that mm-hmm. you're writing.
Which is such an important thing to remember, because we all kind of tend to freak out with this horrible burden of influence that we feel from other authors and other versions of stories that we've read. But my Kermit is going to be different from your Kermit.
Mm-hmm.
My, you know, monomyth coming of age story is going to be very different from your monomyth coming of age story mm-hmm. or whatever it is that we're writing. And so remembering that you are an important ingredient in your work I think is really vital.
There's a flip side to this. The fear that people are going to read what you've written and just hear you. If you've ever watched a puppeteer on stage sitting visibly right next to the puppet, and performing the puppet, they vanish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They vanish completely. And it's surprisingly easy for us as writers to vanish into our prose. It doesn't make our voice go away, but we can disappear.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's really important about having your own personal voice, right? The thing that is really intrinsic to how you write, how you think, how you speak, is there's a term called anxiety of influence, right? And this is when you are so concerned of like, oh no, I've replicated a plot from Star Wars, I've replicated a beat from this, or a world-building element from Tolkien, or whatever it is. The reason why it's okay to do that, the reason why, not just because it's impossible not to, because you absorb the things you've read, and there's only so many stories and so many things, but because it's all going to be filtered through your natural voice, it will be transformed into something that feels different, right? So when we say that you want to lean into and enhance your voice, this is the component we're talking about, this natural style that you have, that will, everything will be rendered through it and therefore feel different if you allow yourself that kind of distinctiveness of the way you think and write.
So bringing this back to puppetry, I just watched a documentary about Jim Henson called Idea Man,
mm-hmm.
Which is wonderful. And one of the interesting things in there is when they were talking about how he and his wife were just barely getting started, the reason that Kermit as a character took off was in part because the hand was so visible inside the puppet. Not only did it make it more malleable and you could do a lot of facial expressions, but you watch those early things and you can see the fingers inside of Kermit's head. And that was something that they liked about it, that it made the puppet so particularly expressive of the puppeteer that personal style came through really strongly.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that it's difficult to remember now, because all of us have grown up with Sesame Street and with the moving mouth, hand and rod style being the predominant style. But when they started doing that, the predominant style was marionettes. The mm-hmm. huge puppeteer at the time was Bill Baird. He was a marionettist. You've seen his work if you've seen Sound of Music. He built those marionettes, although the children did actually do the performance. Mm-hmm. But the that look was the look that everybody was influenced by and mimicking. And Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, those were also these rigid figures. And then Jim Henson comes along with these incredibly malleable figures. And most of the puppetry you see now on television is moving mouth puppets. But you can see the difference between, even though they're all using the same mechanical style now, and everybody has been influenced by Henson, you can see the difference in different designers mm-hmm. as they are working. And I think that that's really exciting. Like when we get so wrapped up in the idea of the original idea, and mm-hmm. it's not that, it's the execution of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting there is you have an intersection of mechanical voice and sort of your natural mm-hmm. voice, right? Because the mechanical voice in this case is allowing for a different emphasis on natural voice.
Yes.
You can see the performer in a different way than you can in marionette. I mean, in marionette, you will still have that natural mm-hmm. voice, I'm assuming. But, you know, as you're saying, in terms of being able to see the hand in the puppet, very unsettling way to put that, by the way. letting the mechanical enhance the natural, I think, is a really wonderful way to do it. So when we talk about fiction being voicey, it is because you have this intersection of these two elements.
Mm-hmm. So all of these things are one of the reasons that I love using puppetry as a metaphor. So now we're going to talk about a different aspect of puppetry to use as a metaphor. And that's talking about genre. So for puppetry, puppetry and science fiction and fantasy, I feel like have a lot in common in that we are both sort of the redheaded stepchild of our parent genre. So puppetry is a form of theater. Mm-hmm. Puppet actors are actors. We think about ourselves as actors. The disparaging thing we talk about people who are not using puppets is that they are meat actors, because we're performing with puppets, they're performing with meat. But the thing is that underneath that, there's this umbrella. So there's this umbrella of puppetry. Like, we have an umbrella of science fiction and fantasy. And then within puppetry, we have hand puppets. And these are all the mechanical style that you use to move the puppet. So you have hand puppets, you have rod puppets, you have shadow puppets, you have body puppets, and you have string puppets. Hand puppets, Kermit the Frog.
The Muppets are mostly hand puppets.
The Muppets are hand puppets, but so are the puppets on Mr. Rogers. Those are also hand puppets. So anything you put your hand inside. Rod puppets are any puppet that's worked with a stick, that goes from Sicilian rod marionettes to Wayan Golek. You guys can go look these things up. They're amazing and beautiful. But the one you've probably seen, Slimy the Worm on Sesame Street. And also Rizzo the Rat. Those are both controlled with a literal stick up their ass.
And you thought I was making bad metaphors here.
Oh, Rizzo, I'm so sorry.
If anyone did not deserve it, it would be Rizzo. Then you've got shadow puppets, or screen puppets, they're sometimes called. And that's anything where you're looking at an image on a screen.
Tara Walker's work, for example.
Perfect. If you've got, you've probably done a shadow puppet where you've done the dog with your hand. It's one of the oldest forms of puppetry, but you can also do it with overhead projectors. Within each of these, you get to drill down again. Then we've got string puppets, which are marionettes, but they can also be cable control. For instance, in the original Little Shop of Horrors, the giant puppet is a cable controlled puppet. Those are mechanical cables that people are actually moving. That's also a string puppet. And then body puppet is any puppet you put your entire body inside.
Jack, not name, Jack Job.
Big Bird, Snuffy. So within all of those, again, you can drill down farther. And it's the same thing with science fiction and fantasy, where you have science fiction, but then you also have space opera, you have near future, you have far future. What's interesting is the mashups. So we just mentioned Kermit the Frog. Kermit the Frog is actually a mashup that had never happened before. But he's a mashup of two styles that were not commonly mixed, which is hand puppet and rod puppet. Mm-hmm. Rod puppets did not exist in the European vocabulary of puppetry until the early 1900s. And that they were brought over from Asia, from specifically Javanese puppets. And without that mingling of that conversation between these two different cultures, these two different styles of puppetry, we would not have Kermit the Frog. We wouldn't have the type of puppetry that we experience today. And I think it's the same thing when we're talking about science fiction and fantasy, like steampunk. Is steampunk fantasy or science fiction?
Who cares?
Who cares? Exactly. It's a mashup.
Yeah.
Is the Swedish chef a hand puppet or hands? He's got a pair of human hands.
He's got a pair of human hands.
And who cares?
Yeah.
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 I just want to watch him.
Yeah.
But it's also, what I love is you talk about the lineages of puppetry too, as you talk about these genres, right? Of, you know, where the rod puppetry comes from. And it goes back to, you know, space opera. The reason we call it space opera is it comes out of a genre called horse opera, which is a type of Western, right? And so the dominance of Westerns as pulp fiction in the early 20th century then transitions into spaceships and ray guns as technology evolves, as, you know, we enter sort of the atomic era, and then the horse opera becomes the space opera.
My brain, oh my gosh, you said horse opera, and the first thing I thought was, that's ridiculous, horses can't sing, and space can,
right?
What? And McCaffrey made it happen, you know, got the spaceship who sang, right? Yeah. But you know, and that goes further back into opera tradition. Mm-hmm. It literally was called horse opera because it was taking the high stakes and melodrama from opera, translating it into the American West, and all of this. So all of this is, genre is about legacy and tradition as well. And the ways you can combine them is so novel and exciting.
I think that this is a good opportunity for us to pause. And when we come back, we're going to talk more puppets.
Heading into the new year, we're all thinking about what our intentions and goals are. It's hard not only to set your targets, but live up to them, especially as writers and creatives in a world that doesn't always seem eager to support you financially. That's why building your financial literacy and starting to work towards a stable financial base is an important aspect of developing your writing career. We talk a lot about the creative tools you need, but peace of mind about your bottom line will give you the space to pursue your goals and develop the career that you want. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorn lets you invest with the spare money you've got right now. You can start with $5 or even just your spare change. Head to acorns.com/WX or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/WX.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice boneless chuck roast or stew meat for $6.99 a pound. Then get 2-liter bottles of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $1.49 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Got great ideas, but no idea how to build a website? Get Bluehost. Their AI design tool creates high-quality WordPress sites super fast. Whether you're a blogger, influencer, or launching a side hustle, Bluehost helps boost your growth with built-in marketing and e-commerce tools. Upgrade to cloud to get 100% uptime and 24/7 security to stay online all the time. Why wait? You've got the vision. Make it real. Visit Bluehost.com to get started.
All right. Do we want to move on to one more puppet thing?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. So we're going
to... I just want to pause and say this is so delightful and so fun to dig deep into this topic. I mean, you've brought this up over and over again throughout the show, but like to get it all in one place, I'm finding very delicious to go through one of the host's minds and how they think about it and approach it and all these things.
The thing that's missing from the whole legend, the whole mythos of writing excuses is video of Brandon, Dan, and Howard slack-jawed as Mary Robinette, who we'd never had as a guest before, guests and talks about puppetry, and all of our minds explode at once. It was delightful.
It was, I have to say, pretty satisfying. but it is, like, the reason that I brought up puppetry was in that episode was that you all had asked me about something about the way I thought about writing. And my background in puppetry has affected everything about the way that I move through my writing career. Mm-hmm. So the next thing we're going to talk about is actually building a puppet. And it affects the way that I think about writing. So I see a lot of writers who get very hung up on, oh, I can't get my opening right. So when I'm building a puppet, I sit down and I first have to think about what kind of puppet I'm going to build. You know, I have to answer those questions about the style of puppet. I have to answer those questions first. And those questions are, you know, informed by a lot of different things. They're informed by what size of my theater. They're informed by who my audience is going to be. They're informed by my budget. And that affects, and this is before I actually get to the building part, which we will also talk about, but that affects my conception. And for me as a writer, when I sit down and think, oh, I'm going to write, sometimes I do just freeform and write in the same way that sometimes you just doodle as an artist. Sometimes you just, like, here's some stuff. I'm going to slap it together and see what happens. But when I'm building something for a show, In the same way that I'm writing something for a themed anthology or for a contract, I think about, what is the size of my theater? Am I writing a short story or am I writing mm-hmm. a novel? Because that's going to affect all of my proportions. Mm-hmm. I think about the audience, because that's going to affect the stylistic choices that I make. And I think about my budget, because my budget for writing is my number of words. Mm-hmm. If I have a really small budget, which is like, you know, a 3,000 word story, I cannot afford to have a lot of sets mm-hmm. because every set costs words.
This is, so when I often talk about publishing advice and writing advice, one thing I say frequently is you have to hold two opposite ideas in your head at mm-hmm. the same time and learn how to live in that contradiction. So the reason I bring that up is, in this case, when it comes to writing your book, I firmly believe you should not think about the market. You should not think about the world. You should just focus on the story you want to write, the book of your heart, all of that. But also, the contradictory advice of what you should do is think about the market, think about the industry, and think about what you want your book to look like in a certain way. And exactly, who's your audience? What's your target word count? If you're writing space opera and you write a 60,000 word novel, sorry, you didn't write a space opera. You wrote a short science fiction novel, right? And so to hit certain genre markers and to hit certain expectations of your audience, you do kind of have to frame things up in a certain way to set those expectations.
So what's interesting is that when I am thinking about audience, I am not thinking about market.
Mm-hmm.
Because specifically because I come out of children's theater, my audience are not the people who are buying the tickets.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about, will this be funny for a third grader? Will they get this reference? Will they be worried about this? Is this too scary for them?
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I have to think about, how do I get their parents to buy a ticket?
Right.
But I don't think about, how do I get their parents to buy a ticket when I am designing it, when I'm coming up with the show.
And maybe that's a useful distinction between thinking about audience when you're starting to craft versus thinking about audience when you're getting ready to pitch, right? Because those are two very different stages of the project with two very different mindsets and approaches. And when you start thinking too much about the marketing and the publishing framing, I think that can infect your work in a way that can be limiting. But I do think it's important to think about, who do you want to read this book? Mm-hmm. Who is this book for on some level?
I think one of the challenges that many writers, new writers, old writers, established, published, whatever, many of us face is the discovery right about the time, and I'm going to lean into the puppetry metaphor in ways that may or may not work, right about the time that you're, you know, hot gluing the last bits of whatever to your hand puppet, and you realize, oh, wait, this hand puppet actually needs to be 8 feet across and be driven by cables. And I need to now go rewrite my whole book because I've discovered something about it that says this structure isn't right. And I didn't know how to build, Audrey 2. But then I saw a book or read a thing or learned a thing. And now I know, oh my goodness, there's this whole structure that I didn't know how to use. That's the structure I really needed for my book. And I just finished hot gluing a thing.
We are 100% going to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to actually, unless someone else wants to talk about audience, I'm going to use that as my segue. So I've been talking about the decisions I have to make before I start building. When I start building, the first thing that I do is I do a drawing of what I want it to look like. This drawing does not include what it looks like on the inside. But after I've got this kind of general, like, this is the vibe that I'm going for, then I have to sit down and I have to start thinking about the interior structure. And I work in layers. So I will draw the body parts that are going to be there. I will draw, like, where does this have to fit? I will draw those things, and then I will start putting layers on top of that to figure out what I need. Then, after I've got that sketch, that's not the puppet. I've got that sketch, and then I have to build, most of the time, if I've got a puppet that's that's like paper mache or something, often I have to start with building an armature. And then I put clay on the armature and I do additive and subtractive sculpture where I'm putting clay on and then I'm pulling it off and I'm slowly refining into the shape that I want. Then I do a mold and then I paper mache into that and then I have to sand it and then I get to do my painting. Then I get to glue all of the details on. If I just jumped straight to the sculpture, frequently it would collapse. Frequently it wouldn't have a spot to put my hand. And so when I'm writing, what I often start with is that I start with, you'll hear me talk sometimes about a thumbnail sketch, which is a term that comes out of my art background, which is just a little drawing, just a little bit like, this is the vibe. And that for me with writing is, sometimes it's a log line, Jane Austen with magic. Mm-hmm. This is the vibe. Sometimes it is a paragraph of, you know, asteroid slams into the earth in 1952. There's a lot of chaos and then ladies go to space. You know, it's just very rough sketch. And then I will unpack that. Then I start to move towards my armature, which is my outline or my synopsis. But the thing for me is that at every stage of that, I am discovering something new. And I know that I'm going to discover something new in every stage. So having gone through that with puppetry, when I'm doing that in writing, it gives me this freedom because I know that I don't have to be locked in. I know I'm still going to be making discoveries. And particularly as a writer with ADHD, it gives me a bunch of, you did that. Now you get to do this next thing, knowing that there's still going to be discovery.
I have never, not even one time while writing, given myself third degree burns with a hot glue gun.
You're missing out.
You're missing out. Yeah. I have two different spots from puppets. Two different third degrees from puppets, yeah. Yeah, the one of the things that I do like about writing is that it is significant. I am injured significantly less.
I mean, we could consider carpal tunnel to be a form of a hot glue burn. So, you know,
Sorry, go ahead.
No. Just more jokes.
One of the great things about starting with that thumbnail sketch for me is that it helps me pitch the story later on. Mm-hmm. If I have a really succinct starting point, you know, if I know what the core framework or skeleton of this story is, I know what the vibe is, then it's so much easier to tell it to people. And I know, you know, I can pitch a John Cleaver book or I can pitch one of my cyberpunk books really easily, whereas my partial series, I didn't start with that. I started from a completely different direction. And to this day, 15 years later, it's hard for me to summarize in, you know, one sentence or even one paragraph what that book is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, when I work with clients, one of my favorite stages is this first stage where we're coming up with the pitch, right? They're pitching me on ideas, a couple sentences, a paragraph, whatever it is. And then we just start, like you were saying, like accreting more and more layers onto that as it develops into something richer. But you got to have that pitch out of the gate, for me at least, to feel really confident that this project is going to work at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I want to say that just because I tend to work that way, mm-hmm. there are also times and joy in working the other direction, where you're like, here's a bunch of ingredients that I have. Mm-hmm. Here's a bunch of materials. What can I make out of that? There's something in puppetry we call a found object puppet, where you make a puppet come to life with using the mechanical principles of how puppetry works. If anyone has ever seen me do the puppetry demonstration live in person, you've seen me do Scarf Dragon, where I take just a scarf and turn it in. But we do this with like newspaper, shoes, water bottles, whatever it is. We just like, well, put these objects together.
There's a photo on the internet somewhere of Mary Robinette menacing me with a napkin puppet that is very delightful to me. But yeah.
There's a... I also fond memories of that anytime I get to be menacing. There's a wonderful puppeteer named Paul Zaloom, and I think you'll be able to find some of his work on YouTube, but he does found object puppetry where he will glue different pieces mm-hmm. together. So sometimes that's fun. Sometimes you do the drawing and then you're like, okay, but what structure has to be under it to support that? Mm-hmm. So it's not that you have to always start from the inside, but it is the, what is the vibe? What am I going for? And that I can work in layers.
Well, there's one last element of this, and I know we're running long, but I kind of wanted to bring this up. Well, as you're talking about building, there's a thing that, as I've been in the industry longer and longer, one of the things that has been most useful to me is to step back and remember that a book is a physical object.
Mm-hmm.
That we...
Sometimes.
A lot of the time. Not always, right? But like the core of what the publishing industry is a physical goods mm-hmm. business. We print books, we ship them to thousands of stores around the country, and then those are sold by hand to a customer, right? Yes, there are ebooks, there are audiobooks, there's a million other things that sort of that branch off from that. But the origin of the business and still the commercial heart of the business is the physical business, right? And so sometimes remembering that what you are making is a physical object in the way that you are thinking about building a puppet and what that means for the space that you're in, the shape that you're in, the materials you're using, you know, I think there's a very, very useful metaphor to remember that a book is a thing that you want to hand to a person at the end of the day.
When I did the translation for Hildur Knut's daughter's The Night Guest, one of the things that she was very specific about is that there are some chapters that are only one sentence long. Mm-hmm. And she was very specific about which side of the page that sentence was on.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about physically building puppets. I'm remembering another thing from this Henson documentary about Rolf the dog.
Mm.
He was, for a long time, the breakout Muppet. Before Kermit, before Sesame Street, he was the big one. And that was pure experimentation. Their guy who was their main Muppet maker cut a basketball in half, more or less because he wanted to see what he could do with it. And he ended up, that's why Rolf has this giant kind of spherical looking head with this enormous mouth, because he was built from a basketball cut in half. And that kind of experimentation where you don't have a plan in advance,
mm-hmm.
you just have stuff and you have ideas and you want to see what you can put together. Some of my best writing I've ever done comes from that kind of, let's see what happens.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to, because I just need to hit the focus, those things, because in episode 314, I did not have a good way to talk about muscle, and I do now. So focus indicates thought. What your character is looking at is what your character is thinking about. It's whatever they notice, sounds, scent, touch. That's what is important to the character. That's the thing that is in the front of their brain. Breath indicates emotion. So breath and rhythm are closely related. If you walk into a room and you are breathing rapidly, it reads differently than if you walk into a room and take a very big sigh. But those are both mechanically breaths. For on the page, that's your sentence structure. How long your sentences are, how long your paragraphs are, those affect the way the reader, the pace and the way the reader feels about it. Muscle, which is the idea that the puppet moves itself. In writing, I've started calling this internal motivation. What is moving your character? What is making your character make choices? Because you want all of those things to appear to originate from inside the character, as opposed to having the puppeteer's hand reach on stage and move a prop. And then meaningful movement, when your character moves, when they're doing body language, that body language is as important as the dialogue. So those are the things. Everything else you can, most everything else we talk about in 314, if you want to go back and listen to that. Thank you all so much for joining me on my Let Me Talk About Puppets. I could actually keep talking about it. But those are the things that shape the way I approach writing. Because it was such a huge part of my life for so long. So we're going to be talking about this kind of thing all season. We've got other metaphors that other people are going to be bringing to you. Right now, I have a little bit of homework. And that's, I just want you to watch a puppet show. If you can find a live puppet show in person, that would be amazing. Go to puppeteers.org if you're in the United States. That's Puppeteers of America. You can look for your regional guild. Most of the time they will list shows that are happening. If you're not in the United States, you can look at Unima, UNIMA.com. There's Unima is the oldest continually operating arts organization in the world. It's Union de la Internationale de la Marionette. I'm saying this very, very badly. But you can, again, find a puppet show near you. And if you can't do that, check YouTube. There's so many fantastic, amazing puppet shows. But look at watch a puppet show. And I specifically want you to watch something that's not the Muppets. Just so that you can see how many different amazing styles out there are out there. This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go watch puppets.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Aaron Roberts, Dan Wells, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
Stay warm and save every day. All in the Kroger app. Get tender USDA Choice boneless chuck roast or stew meat for $6.99 a pound. Then get 2 liter bottles of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $1.49 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.